pianist, starting with Carl Engel, the first of our Sunday supplements, recording suggested by you and chosen by us, and the first in a very varied series of 20th century string quartets, Alfred Schnittke's Third, played by the Pacifica Quartet. My singing star is the mightily impressive bass baritone George London, and my theme between 10 and 11 is a very international selection of songs scored for voice and orchestra. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3. Studio production this morning was by Lyndon Jones. In just a moment, a real-life 007 is Michael Barclay's guest. And another thoroughly nice person is our Composer of the Week this week.
My final Composer of the Week for 2014... and my first Composer of the Week for 2015 was a lawyer. Although a trip to Germany, where he heard Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, put paid to that. He was born in 1841, and many consider him to be the forerunner of the modern school of classical music. Indeed, Ravel declared that this composer had changed the direction of French harmony. Oh, and apparently, he was a terribly nice guy. Who is he? Emmanuel Chabrier, my Composer of the Week, starting tomorrow from midday here on BBC Radio 3.
Back to today, and a little later this afternoon, we're going to go wassailing in the company of Lucy Skeeping, who'll investigate the origins of the tradition, no doubt hearing the music and sampling the mulled cider that was all part of the process. The early music show is at 2 o'clock this afternoon. But it's now midday and time on Radio 3 for Michael Barclay to introduce a very special guest on Private Passions.
James Bond, Simon Templar, my guest today can only be Roger Moore. He played Bond for 12 years in 7 films, more than any other actor, and before that he was a hugely loved figure throughout the 60s as Simon Templar, the Saint. In fact, he's rarely been off the big and small screens since he began his acting career in 1945, working as an extra alongside his idol Stuart Granger in Caesar and Cleopatra. Before television and film, Roger, you had a rather successful career, I think, as a knitwear model.
That continues to haunt me. I did about 1 year of while I was understudying in a couple of plays in London, and I was able to have time to do a few knitwear patterns. So Michael Caine has dubbed me the Big Knit, and all sorts of people produce old knitting patterns.
What I liked about your book very much, and indeed even the way you recall this, is that you enjoy these funny sides to life as much as we all do discovering them.
Well, there have to be funny sides to life. If you take everything seriously, you're not going to have a very long life. All the people I knew that were very serious about everything, they've gone.
Roger, you grew up in South London in the 1930s, the son of a policeman. It's rather a nice irony that one of the parts you're best known for is Simon Templar and the Saint, because that was a Robin Hood-type figure who sometimes went either side of the law, didn't he?
Only cheated crooks. And, of course, in television, because it was shown in so many countries, you had so many different ethics to pay heed to, and so they said that children would be affected by it, so Simon Templar could only punch on the chin, never in the stomach, could never pick up a bottle and break it and stab somebody in the face, which is the way people win fights. Mm. The nice people don't win fights.
Music has always been quite a vital part of your life, hasn't it? And you have a really genuine love of it. And I think the first piece comes from a film you made in 1984 called The Naked Face.
Mm-hmm.
Made quite a lasting impression on you.
Yes, it was directed by Brian Forbes. And I'd said to him, I think the character I'm playing, who was a psychiatrist and his wife had died, and he very often came back to his apartment and he put on music. And I said, Brian, I'd like this music.
Do you find Mozart a kind of Shakespearean god, as it were, because he can sort of do anything?
I would say that every composer is a god to me. The ability to take those very few notes, actually, move them around and very, very rarely make one sound like the other. But, by the same token, the genius, they have a style, and you say, that is Mozart, or that's Verdi, that's Puccini. They have that ability to be individual with so few notes at their fingertips. Oh, that was wonderful. That's wonderful. I was almost dropping off to sleep because it's one of our bedtime tunes. Mm. I have it on my iPhone, and about 10 minutes before we're due to sleep, we sort of close the books and I put the music on. My wife studied ballet when she was little, and she does a little dance. And I get up and I try to dance. I try to move my old arthritic knees into tempo. We have a little of that music, and then light goes off. It's one of our bedtime tunes.
It's got a wonderful, effortless sense of space. It just unfolds, doesn't it, so naturally. And so when he puts in that sudden chord, which I notice you immediately, da 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 dee da dee dee ba dee, the sort of suspension.
Talent, talent, talent.
The slow movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20 in D minor, with the pianist Maria João Pires and Claudio Abbado conducting the Orchestra Mozart. You have a particular love of opera, Puccini and Verdi, and that also began, I think, with a film in 1955, very early on in your Hollywood career.
Yes, I was very fortunate enough to make a film with Eleanor Parker, in which she played Marjorie Lawrence, Australian operatic star who developed poliomyelitis. And I played her brother, Cyril. And we had wonderful excerpts from all of the operas and liking and having a great affection for music, and music of any sort apart from yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a wonderful time on the film.
We hear the voice of singer Eileen Farrell in the film, but Eleanor Parker, the actress who played Marjorie Lawrence, I think she spent weeks preparing for the role and actually sang rather than lip-sync, didn't she, during filming? Which is pretty admirable.
You know, when asked, who have you really worked with that you thought was great? And I think Eleanor Parker was the first and one of the only who was a really accomplished actress, who was a really caring actress, was most unselfish. And I was secretly in love with her. She, of course, she was married to a wonderful painter, and I was married elsewhere. So.
Have you ever been required to sing in your career?
Oh dear, yes. The first play I did at the Art Theatre in 1944, which I was a gendarme, and I played a guest at a wedding, and I played a cousin, and I had to sing at the beginning of with the entire cast. We're up for the wedding of dear little Helen to Mr. Fadden. Ah, full of elation, we ride in procession along the boulevard. Uncles and aunties by the score, dozens of cousins and friends galore. Proud of our finery, up to the ninery on the boulevard.
You obviously remember your lines.
Well, I remember the lines. The melody's a little off.
Well, after that, I think the prelude to Traviata is going to be something of a disappointment.
No, not at all. Traviata, wonderful, wonderful.
Thank you.
Extraordinary how many incredible ideas we had there in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, every aspect of kind of human emotion, you know, but managing to put a tune over it that completely tears at one.
And also, it's also telling you that, like most operas, she's going to die.
Yes.
Yeah. And not with a smile on her face, maybe with a tender note.
Interestingly enough, I was talking to a novelist friend the other day. He was saying how often operas have very tragic endings, and it moves us because, of course, it's like life. Whereas I think a lot of films and a lot of novels tend to have happier endings.
You're supposed to leave the cinema, I suppose, feeling a little better. The music makes up for the tragedy, I think, with opera.
I think we go there to be disturbed almost, don't we?
Yes, you know, it's like the ladies are going to be, oh, what a lovely time. You know, I did have a good cry.
The prelude to Verdi's La Traviata, the wonderful Carlos Kleiber conducting the Bavarian State Orchestra. Roger, you spent 12 years playing James Bond. We've got a rather nice clip here from The Spy Who Loved Me in 1977. And here you are with a Russian secret agent, played by Barbara Bach, discovered at the end of the film, canoodling, shall we say, in an escape pod, much the same size as this studio, on the ocean, and much to the consternation of your respective superiors.
Double O 7.
Triple X.
Bond, what do you think you're doing?
Keeping the British end up, sir.
You must have enjoyed moments like that.
I enjoyed every moment of it.
Because, as you were saying, I mean, I was saying earlier that, you know, you are able to smile at yourself, as it were, and those films, incredibly professionally made, brilliantly made, and brilliantly acted, but they're a wonderful sort of send-up as well as being exciting and funny.
This has been one of the problems with the imitators that followed up, where they were trying to make a parody of Bond, and Bond is a parody in itself. They said, yes, you bring a lighter touch to it. I read the scripts. I knew I was going to win.
I suppose that scene, which, you know, is rather typical of many in the Bond films, and fulfills or would fulfill most men's ultimate fantasy. Did it live up to that for you, that life, getting the best tables, beautiful women? Or did you even sometimes get fed up with the sort of shaken, not stirred jokes?
Well, I never had to say shaken, not stirred. The one thing that was said all the time to me, you walk into any bar and they say you're going to shake and not stir. So I always said that what sort of spy was Bond, because everybody knew that he wanted martini. Mr. Bond, Commander Bond, shaken, not stirred, yes. That's not a spy. Spies are faceless people, rather like the Jackal.
You didn't do a film for some years after Bond, 5 years, I think. Was that a sort of conscious... Ooh,
that is absolutely unforgivable.
But maybe it's M.
It is. It is M. Let me turn that right off. Sorry. Anyway.
You didn't appear in a film for a few years after Bond. Did you deliberately want to kind of leave filmmaking for a while, or was it just what happened?
Well, the films I was being offered after I finished were all Bondian. Mm. And I couldn't make an imitation of Bond. That wasn't on the cards. So I just didn't do anything. I made a couple of movies made for television in Canada. I was quite happy playing a lot of tennis, enjoying myself.
And listening to opera.
Yes.
Because the next piece is from another Verdi opera, Rigoletto. And I find the scenario of this opera utterly devastating. When Rigoletto realizes that through his kind of manipulations, he has brought about the death of the creature he loves more than anyone else in the world, his daughter, it's absolutely... finishes one. And you particularly wanted Joan Sutherland.
Yes, I was the chairman of an organisation. It was called Spastics in those days, which we're not allowed to say, but physically impaired homes that we ran. And we had a fundraiser one night, and our president was the Duchess of Kent, and we had a concert at the Albert Hall. And in the interval, I had to present Joan Sutherland to the Duchess of Kent. And afterwards, we went to dinner at the Barclay. And I sat next to Joan Sutherland, you know, who, as you know, was a very tall lady. And she looked at me and she said, "You know something? You're a real beaut." She said, "Mark Hugh, you're not as beaut as my hubby there, who is conducting this, by the way, Richard Bonnie." I was this extraordinary woman, this extraordinary voice. And you remind me, Ellen, you're beaut. Bella figlia, bell'amore, schiavo son dei vezzi tuoi, con detto, un detto sole, senti del mio cuore il frequente palpito.
Piangere non vuoi.
The quartet from Act 3 of Verdi's Rigoletto, with Joan Sutherland, and that's a beaut of a voice, isn't it?
That is a voice.
Luciano Pavarotti, Huguet Turango, and Cheryl Milnes. Richard Bonning was conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. And by the way, you can find details of all of Roger Moore's music on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You have many musician friends, Roger, and one of those is the violinist Julian Racklin, who has a festival every year in Dubrovnik, and I think he asked you to narrate Carnival of the Animals.
Yes, I was terrified, because the only time I'd ever done any narrating to music was at a tribute evening one night in California for Leslie Bricus and Tony Newley. Leslie, a brilliant lyricist, and he'd written lyrics for Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which Peter O'Toole was playing Mr. Chips. And I had to recite, because I couldn't sing, the words of the school hymn. In the morning of my life, I look to the sunrise and the blessing I shall ask. Only God can grant me to be brave and strong and true. And as I started this, and the lights went down, and there was just a little spot on my face, and behind me there's absolutely the most wonderful music from Henry Mancini and his orchestra. And the nerves started, and I could feel my fingers starting to twitch, and I put my hand in my pocket so nobody would see my hand shaking, if they could see my hand. And that took my leg started to shake, and then that went through the floor, and my other leg started, and I was absolutely, but I was still, my face just stayed absolutely. And I thought, that's going to happen to me while I'm doing Carnival of the Animals. It didn't. Thank goodness.
Thank you.
Just transported back to any number of occasions when narrating, I would sit centre, cello on my left, Misha, and just turn on my stool and go into a trance. And it was very difficult to come out of it at the end. It's so beautiful that when he hangs on the last note.
The Swan from the Carnival of the Animals by Camille Saint-Saëns. Misha Maisky was the cello soloist, accompanied in that orchestral arrangement by the Orchestra of Paris, conducted by Semyon Bishkov. Roger Moore, you narrated that suite at Julian Racklin's festival in Dubrovnik, as we heard. Like you, he's a UNICEF goodwill ambassador. Yes. And you've spent much of the last 20 years travelling the world and working for them. How did you come to get involved in that?
That was Audrey Hepburn back in 1990. She was a neighbour in Switzerland. She called me and said, would I come to Amsterdam with her on May the 7th or something to co-host the Danny Kaye International Children's Awards, which was for talented young children with musical ability. So I said, yes, of course. When is it? She said, it's May the 7th. I said, well, I'll be there May the 7th. No, I want you on the 6th, I want you to, at a press conference. I said, but I don't know enough about UNICEF. She said, it doesn't matter. They'll only want to talk about movies. And she was right, they did, but she wouldn't let them. She turned everything back to the plight of children and what we needed and why we had to raise funds. And I became hooked. But the only way I could find out more and not just learn statistics was to go out into the field. So I signed a document saying that I was an official representative, and off I went to Central America.
She always seemed such an endearing character on screen. Was she an endearing personality in real life?
She was one of the most wonderful women in the world. And she was only a goodwill ambassador for 3 or 4 years, and she died, unfortunately, while she was still an ambassador. She was one of the greats.
You've done a huge amount of charity work over the years, and in fact you received your knighthood in 2003 for that work with charities. You said it meant far more to you than if it had been for acting.
Of course, no, it was absolutely for UNICEF, and I'm, in a way, it's for the people that work for this extraordinary organisation, most dedicated group of paid and volunteers.
We were talking earlier about Julian Racklin,
yeah,
and we're going to hear him playing, at your request, the opening of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. Have you seen him do this in concert?
Yes. Yeah, Julian, I've seen any number of concerts with him, and I've worked many, many times with him. He's one of my old friends. Well, he's a young fellow, but he's one of my old friends.
Thank you.
Ah, that's been played, you know, not only by Julian, but also by Jenny Jensen. Mm-hmm.
We heard, as you said, Julian there playing the opening of the Concerto for Violin in D. Vladimir Fedosyev was conducting the Moscow Radio Symphony Orchestra. And happily, we're going to go on and hear Janine, because the fascinating thing is that Tchaikovsky actually wrote another piece as a potential slow movement from the concerto, didn't he?
Yes.
And it's that piece, so it'd be lovely to hear that following this. I don't think we've ever done this before. This is the Mélodie Souvenir d'un lieu cher, the memories of a loved place. Janine Jansson was the soloist in music from the opening movement of Tchaikovsky's Souvenir, Memory of a Dear Place, in an arrangement for strings. Daniel Harding was conducting the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. I think in the final analysis he decided that that was a bit too slight for the slow movement of the violin concerto, so he rewrote the one that we are more familiar with.
But that was beautiful. Yes, that I'm was sitting here in trance.
Yes, it was. You have a real passion for strings, don't you?
Yeah,
cello, violin, and there's another violin coming up.
Well, I'm privileged to be at the right end of violins, not the end holding it, but to listen to it. When I was eight, a great uncle gave a violin to me. And my father took me off to have lessons, and after about 6 weeks, the violin teacher told my father he was wasting his money, wasting his time, and wasting my time. And it was one of my big regrets, that I just didn't.
Well, you found another métier, and one that has allowed you to go to a lot of wonderful concerts and meet a lot of wonderful musicians. And actually that's the case again, because we've got the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto and Nicola Benedetti playing it. And I think you met her at a UNICEF concert.
Yes, she was 17. She had just won the BBC's Young Musician of the Year.
Well, here is Nicola Benedetti with the opening of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto.
Thank you.
The opening of Mendelssohn's violin concerto in E minor, Nicola Benedetti, was the soloist, and she was being assisted in her task by James McMillan, who was conducting the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. You've called your latest book Last Man Standing, and at 86, does that somehow reflect how it feels as you look back at your life and career?
I consider, I'm very lucky, I can't quite understand why people sort of, they say, when you're 80, bless you. and they're all amazed at 86. And I don't quite understand why. But on the other hand, I don't understand why I've been here for 86 years. But I've had a wonderful, wonderful life. And sort of sitting down and reminiscing and thinking back, you realise how much went on and how lucky I was to be there.
You somehow seem very grounded.
Grounded? Flat feet, I suppose.
What, policeman's son?
Yeah, well, yes, that could be the reason.
You just enjoy these things, but it doesn't let you become something other than an ordinary person in a way. You're very easy to communicate with. And...
Well, I am ordinary.
You're James Bond, mate. You can't be completely ordinary.
Well, it's, you know, that's all luck. Mm. Everything is luck.
Thank you very much for sharing the music you feel passionate about and some lovely, lovely stories too.
And thank you for letting me listen to it. Thank you.
Michael Barclay's guest was the actor Sir Roger Moore. The producer was Jane Greenwood for Loftus. Well, next week, Michael Barclay's guest is the charity CEO and cancer blogger Kate Gross, who sadly died earlier this week at the age of only 36. Recorded before her death, her interview with Private Passions is a moving and life-affirming memorial to an extraordinary woman. That's at midday next Sunday here on BBC Radio 3.
Celebrate the new year with music on BBC Radio 3. Once again, the Vienna Philharmonic welcomes the new year with a concert of waltzes, polkas and marches by the Strauss family. This year, Zubin Mehta leads the orchestra in what is one of the most popular concerts in the world. Be part of a global audience of millions who blow away the cobwebs of the night before with a glittering array of Viennese favourites, from the Blue Danube to the Radetzky March. Join me, Petrok Trelawney, for the New Year's Day concert with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, live from the Musikverein in Vienna from 10:15 on New Year's morning, here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, in an hour's time this afternoon, we go wassailing as Lucy Skeeping investigates the origins of wassailing and no doubt samples the mulled cider that's part of the tradition. The early music show is at 2:00 this afternoon. It's 1 minute past one. The news now read by Ian Skelly.
The search for an Air Asia plane with 162 people on board that disappeared while flying from Indonesia to Singapore has ended for the day. The plane lost contact with air traffic control around 40 minutes after leaving the Indonesian city of Surabaya on what should have been a two-hour journey. Indonesia's transport ministry said the pilot had asked permission to change course because of bad weather. Strong winds and high seas are hampering efforts to rescue hundreds of people from a passenger ferry which has caught fire off the Greek coast. The Norman Atlantic was travelling from Patras in Greece to Ancona in Italy. Nearby ships have been called in to help and there are no immediate reports of casualties. Train operators are trying to accommodate the thousands of rail passengers who were prevented from completing their journeys yesterday because of severe disruption on parts of the network. King's Cross station in London has reopened after overrunning engineering works were finally completed overnight. The first big snowfall in the French Alps this winter has caused havoc on the roads at a busy time in the skiing season. Around 15,000 people are estimated to have been stranded in their cars overnight. Many were offered emergency accommodation in local towns and villages. The International Combat Force, ISAF, has marked the formal end to its 13-year military operation against the Taliban in Afghanistan with a ceremony in the capital, Kabul. The American commander, General John Campbell, has told the assembled troops that they'd made Afghanistan stronger and their home countries safer. The remaining forces will now play only a supporting role to the Afghan army. The weather for the afternoon, many places will stay dry with some sunny spells, although there'll be a few patches of fog persisting throughout the afternoon. Some wintry showers will also affect eastern coasts. Top temperatures today, 5 degrees Celsius in London, 4 in Cardiff, 2 in Belfast and 1 in Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by Ian Skelly. Well, now on Radio 3, another chance to hear the lunchtime concert first broadcast 2 weeks ago from Wigmore Hall in London. It's introduced by Sean Rafferty.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall for music from the beginning of one composer's life, Haydn's, and from the very end of another's, Brahms. The Brahms requires the virtuosic beauty of the clarinet, and we have that today in Maximiliano Martin. First, though, it's Haydn and the string quartet, be joining later, the Badke. Haydn was in his 20s and he wrote what he called divertimenti or notturnos, 5-movement works with 2 minuets, one each side of the slow movement, and the first and last movements marked presto. This quartet has acquired the nickname La Chasse because of the 6-8 hunting theme at the very beginning. And here to play the string quartet, Opus 1, number 1 by Haydn, the Badke Quartet.